whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Yes, I'm Ken Winkler. I teach philosophy at Yale, where I've been for 16 or 17 years. Before that, I taught for a long time at Wellesley College. I work not just primarily, but almost exclusively in early modern philosophy, especially the British or English language tradition. So I've done a lot of writing on Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, but I've also worked on so-called secondary figures like Cudworth and Hutcheson and Shaftesbury. And I've written some on Descartes and some on Kant as well. Lately, I've been working in American philosophy. I'm working on a project on a continuous tradition of idealism in American philosophy that stretches from Jonathan Edwards to Martin Luther King. And the main figures in that tradition, or at least the ones that I discuss in a book based on a series of lectures that I gave, are Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thoreau, Josiah Royce, and the people sometimes known as the Boston Personalists. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. So perhaps it was wrong of me to say that I work almost exclusively on early modern philosophy, since that project takes me from the middle of the 18th century until the middle of the 20th.
Well, I'm really fascinated by this idea of tracing the trajectory of philosophical idealism into the American Transcendentalists and into Emerson and Thoreau. It feels like an unusual approach to those authors to sort of look at them through the lens of philosophical theorizing, since they're so essayistic and experiential in a way rather than theoretical. Like, do you feel like there's a tension between the kind of theory and kind of lived approach of the American Transcendentalists, like that your approach is unusual? Like, what has it been like for you working on them from your particular perspective?
Yeah, well, frankly, it's been difficult and even frustrating. And the figure that's given me the most trouble, even though he's the one with whom I feel the greatest sympathy, is Emerson. He's very hard to contain. And I'm trying to make something of him in the way I make things of more philosophically disciplined authors like Berkeley, Hume, or Jonathan Edwards. He doesn't argue. He intuits and then delivers his intuitions. And if questions are raised about the consistency of the intuition of one day with the intuition of the next, you know, his view is, well, that will correct itself. It'll become apparent that one of those intuitions wasn't what it seemed to be or what I took it to be at the time. I'm trying to, you know, render him more systematic than he himself is. And I'm still struggling with it, which is why the project is taking me as long as it has. All the other authors are easier to deal with, but that's part of what makes the project interesting to me. Emerson's the central figure in the story I tell for what you might call institutional reasons. He was the paradigm of a philosopher for a lot of his contemporaries, but even he understood himself not to be a professional philosopher, whatever that would have meant in the middle of the 19th century. His successors, Royce is the great example here, were disciplined in much the way we are. In Royce's first book, he lets you know in the preface, this was the religious aspect of philosophy, he lets you know in the preface that it's based on work that was originally submitted as a doctoral dissertation at Johns Hopkins University, which hadn't been founded very long before that. He tells you that parts of it have appeared in some of the recently instituted professional journals. It sounds a lot like the kind of preface that we write nowadays. And when it comes to the climax of his idealist argument, he says, alluding to Emerson, that a conclusion previously reached merely by poetic means has now been made the conclusion of a rigorous deduction or demonstration. So he's a highly professionalized figure, and that professionalism of philosophy is a story I am telling along with the story I'm telling about the arguments.
I'm sort of curious about how this came about. I mean, was it that you were tracing your interest in philosophical idealism from Berkeley sort of forward in time, and this is where it led you? Or were you previously interested in Emerson, say, as a writer, and then sort of backtracked to connect it with the kinds of work you were doing as a historian of early modern philosophy?
I think I was, it's a case of backtracking. When I was teaching at Wellesley when my longtime colleague Ruth Anna Putnam retired. She taught our American philosophy course, which was important to the American studies major, and I decided to take it over because I had done some teaching of pragmatism in my earlier years at Wellesley, but I knew almost nothing about the American philosophical tradition before James. Teaching that course, which was a broad survey, and I teach the same sort of course now at Yale, teaching that course forced me to get acquainted with, or better acquainted with, Edwards, Emerson, and Thoreau. And all three of them just made a tremendous impression on me. And I think the main or first reason why they made such an impression is that their writing is in different ways enormously powerful. And I realize now late in my career that I'm attracted to writing on figures whose writing I admire. So I found it, in one way, I found myself very comfortable working on figures like that. But in another way, it's been challenging because while people like Edwards and Emerson and Thoreau are not major figures in philosophy, they are very major figures elsewhere. There's a huge amount written about them. And a lot of what's written about them by people who aren't philosophers is very philosophically rich. So there's a lot to read. And in the case of all of them, but this has been a particular struggle with me in the case of Emerson and Thoreau, they wrote a lot. Emerson and Thoreau kept notebooks. I think Emerson left about 3 million words in his journals, and Thoreau 2 million, and reading all that and trying to make one's way through it is really rewarding. And I should also say, amazing. In Emerson's case in particular, it's amazing how finished the prose is, even though these entries were apparently dashed off. It's been very rewarding, but also it's also contributed to the difficulty of the project and to the challenge I face in bringing skills that were developed to the extent they were in dealing with philosophers like Locke and Hume to bear on these more elusive, harder to contain figures like Thoreau and especially Emerson.
Well, your attraction to philosophers who write powerfully maybe brings us close to the first official question about temperament. So I'm going to turn to the inspiration for the podcast, who's another philosopher like Emerson, who's on the borders of literature and philosophy, which is Iris Murdoch, who begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but who also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So does your temperament influence your philosophical work? And if so, how?
That's a complicated question for me, and perhaps it has been for other historians of philosophy you've spoken to, because I consider myself a philosopher, and I think that what it is that I do, though it's historical in aim or intention, is a philosophical activity, and that at least in the way I do it, it requires the person doing it to be a philosopher. But I feel when I look at that remark of Murdoch's that I need to account for the fact that I'm doing the history of philosophy rather than what you might think of as, I don't mean to be endorsing this, but rather than philosophy itself. So I'll just say a few things about my temperament that have influenced me, although I'm not sure they'll get to what makes this remark of Murdoch's interesting. I just find myself attracted to old and neglected things. I'll begin by saying that. And I also enjoy finding things out. And I think Isaiah Berlin said something like this when he explained his own transition from philosophy proper, as it might be called, to the history of ideas. He said there was, you know, a pleasure in being able to discover things or settle things in a way one can't in philosophy. So I do find the study of philosophy's past very satisfying to my curiosity. And I find myself especially curious, as I said earlier, about old and neglected things. I'll stop there. That answers part of your question. Why is it that I am a student of the history of philosophy rather than what one might think of as philosophy proper? And the answer might be because of this, the way in which I'm drawn to what I've called old and neglected things, and my interest in satisfying my curiosity by discovering settled things. I don't mean to be saying, by the way, that the conclusions that I reach as an historian of philosophy are settled things, but in arriving at those conclusions, I lay bare or benefit from others' discoveries of settled things, of which I can then make interpretive use.
Well, I think you're second-guessing there pointed to what I was going to ask about anyway, which was the idea that on the one hand, in doing the history of philosophy, there is more clearly a kind of concrete, objective subject matter about which one can discover things, some of them old, neglected, surprising, and forgotten. But if you do history of philosophy the way you do, which is as a philosopher, the kinds of questions that you write about are going to be ones that are disputed too, that the interpretive questions will be disputed. So I kind of wonder, yeah, how far the sort of satisfactions are frustrated by the fact that this alarmingly little agreement about the interpretation of some of the central figures. I mean, the figure I know best in that period is Hume, and Hume is distinctive, I think, in that many of the doctrines that are called Humean, it's at least unclear that he held.
Right,
the things he's famous for, yeah, maybe he didn't believe any of those. So there's something frustrating too about it. I mean,
I will report that I'm not frustrated by it. And maybe I can mention another aspect of my temperament, which will be helpful here, even if it doesn't seem altogether consistent with the aspects I've already identified. I tend to be of skeptical disposition, and finding the state of affairs among historians of philosophy with respect to someone like Hume unsettled doesn't trouble me. I mean, plenty of things are settled, I think. And for all of us, despite our disagreements, those settled facts, if you like, are playing a role in the interpretive arguments that we make. But the fact that they're not settled, my curiosity is very satisfied by what I'm able to discover, or by what I or others and my own self are able to discover. And it's not subsequently frustrated or defeated by the fact that we can't seem to reach agreement on the grand interpretive questions that interest us in the first place. Iris Murdoch speaks of the attempt to discover the truth. And when I'm in an interpretive argument, I am very interested in discovering the truth. And also, I have to confess, interested, if I can manage it, in vindicating my own impression of what is the truth. So on the one hand, I am, if you like, self-centeredly or egoistically pursuing the defense of a position to which I may have been clinging. But at the same time, and maybe this happens after the heat of argument, but it's still a genuine part of my temperament, I'm able to step back and reflect on the state of the discussion and think of the state of the discussion as something in which we all collaborate, and in which we collaborate by pursuing our more individual or self-centered ends. So if you ask me for a reading of Hume that I'm most satisfied by, and I could somehow present you with it, it would be the state of discussion with respect to a particular question rather than any single contribution to that discussion. I hope that makes sense. So I'm imagining as a participant in these arguments that on the one hand, I'm defending a certain point of view I take to be true. Of course, often I don't take any particular view of the matter at hand to be true, in which case I don't quite do this. But I can, on the one hand, defend the view that I take to be true, and on the other hand, think that what I'm, the most significant contribution I'm making is the contribution I'm making toward creating this large discussion that includes many other voices besides my own.
Well, we've sort of talked about the attraction to old and neglected things, the satisfaction of finding them out, and this, your skeptical disposition. So maybe I'll pivot to question two about traits you don't have. Is there a trait you wish you had more of as a philosopher?
Yes. And if I had more of this trait, perhaps I'd be more of a philosopher and less of a historian than I am. And by the way, I don't mean to be saying that the study of the history of philosophy is not itself part of philosophy, but I hope everyone will understand the kind of received contrast that I'm working with there when I speak in the ways in which I've been speaking. Yeah, there is a trait I wish I had more of as a philosopher. My tendency in philosophy is to, well, my greatest joy in philosophy is to read philosophical texts with others, whether it's in class, whether it's in a discussion group, whether it's in a one-on-one conversation. That's my greatest pleasure. And especially in my classes, I see myself as philosophizing with the assistance of those texts. So I'm very text-dependent in my philosophizing. And I admire philosophers from both the past and present who, it seems to me, proceed in brave independence of the text, or in relatively brave or bold independence of texts in a way that I can't. So I'm especially impressed by philosophers who can conduct these long continued arguments that are, of course, informed by the work of others, but which are not, as they proceed, as dependent on the work of others, and certainly not dependent on readings of the works of others in the way I think my own way of proceeding tends to be.
I think there's a similar contrast among non-historians too. I think it's G.E. Moore somewhere who says that he would never have been gripped by philosophical problems had it not been for the bizarre things that other philosophers said about them. And the provocation was other philosophers saying perverse and uncommonsensical things.
Right.
Do you have an example, when you think about philosophers who have the kind of independence you're talking about, are there paradigms that leap to mind of philosophers in history going off on their own in that way?
There are examples. And actually, Moore is one that I would cite, even though the book I'm about to mention now, because I think this is Moore's great contribution along the lines I've just sketched out. The example that comes to mind is Principia Ethica, even though he's certainly responding at times to strange things that others have said, for example, about the good. His point being that pretty much everybody in the past who's tried to say what the good is has said a strange thing about it. But the argument of the whole book, it's just a remarkable performance, I think. He's influenced by outside forces, and perhaps above all by forces he's reacting against. But it's, and again, I'm thinking now of the whole book and not just the opening pages of the book. It's a very complicated, continuous argument conducted, to my mind anyway, in more independence of the writing of others than my own efforts in this direction would be. Another example is Berkeley's theory of vision. He's certainly influenced by early theorists of vision, but it's another impressive long continued argument, which has this quality of relative independence and resoluteness that I wish I could manage myself. Let's see, what are some other examples? Well, there are stretches of Hume's treatise that are this way. And a contemporary example, someone whose work I very much admire, is Susanna Siegel. She just, seizes on a problem and then thinks hard about it in a way that's, of course, informed by the work of others and is supported by judicious references to the work of others, but which is much more independent than anything I feel I could easily manage or manage at all. And that's the trait I wish I had more of. And if I had more of it, perhaps I would not, my writing would not be as text dependent as it is.
Well, I love the fact that this question led us to an interpretive dispute about Moore, who I was citing on one side of things and could easily be cited, as you said, on the other side of it. I'm going to turn us away from the discipline of philosophy for maybe the next two questions. And I'll start with question three. If you weren't a philosopher, what would you do?
Well, one thing I thought very seriously about being when I was in college was, or becoming, if I could become it. And you ask, of course, what would you do? But the kinds of things that I have aspired to do are the kind of things one can only hope to do, it seems to me, since succeeding at it depends on luck or good fortune. I thought about becoming a journalist, and I worked on my college newspaper and spent a lot of energy on that. And I had a job in between my junior and senior year of college. This was in New York in 1970. I'm from New York, so 1970 is a very long time ago. And I was an office boy, as the job that I held was called, for a magazine called Scanlon's. That's probably not familiar to you, am I right?
You are right. I do not know Scanlon's.
Yeah, it didn't last very long, but it was edited by two people, a man named Sidney Zion, who was in charge of the New York office, who'd been the Metropolitan Legal Correspondent for the New York Times, and then a more famous man named Warren Hinkle, who was in San Francisco and had been the longtime editor of a very well-known magazine called Ramparts. So Scanlon's was a muckraking magazine that supported itself with a sale of stock so that it wouldn't have to accept advertising, the thought being that advertising was a corrupting force. And I fell into this job there as an office boy. And I had what was, I think, the most exciting summer of my life. I felt the romance of the New York journalistic world. This was a very informal operation. You know, the magazine had just begun. It only made it through 8 issues. They were running through the money they raised with the stock sale, but they claimed, I'm not sure entirely sincerely, that they were done in by the refusal of American printers to print the last of their issues, which was on guerrilla war in the United States. In any event, I worked in New York. I did an impossibly varied number of things. My immediate boss was an ex-con who was most famous for fixing basketball games and whose underworld connections I discovered as the summer went on had not been entirely done away with, and in which I, in a modest way, even ended up participating. It was just a great summer. So on the one hand, I loved it, and I was very attracted by the thought of being part of it if I could. On the other hand, I was struck by the fact that the people in the positions that I would likely occupy if I made an attempt at this, namely the low-ranking editors who are recent college graduates, they didn't have a lot of independence, it seemed to me. And the independence of an academic life was very appealing to me. And I think the main reason why I set journalism aside, despite the fact that I found that summer so exciting and even romantic.
It does sound a lot more adventurous than the typical life of the philosophy professor. I mean, have you found ways to recapture that sense of adventure and excitement in doing philosophy? Or, you know, or does it feel like the choice was made and you gave up on something, but the compensations were worth it?
That's a good question. It was easy to get up, you know, caught up in the romance of that summer because there were external institutions supporting it. I could meet famous people. I mean, not just philosophy famous people, as my old friend Jonathan Adler used to put it, but people who really were famous. And I think that was a good part of the reason I found it so alluring. But I have to say that Hume says somewhere, I think it's in the Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, that he speaks of study and society as the two greatest or at least purest pleasures of human life. And I'm pretty much on board with that. And I have had intensely pleasurable experiences throughout my time as a philosopher, no matter where I've been teaching. I've had immensely pleasurable experiences talking about talking philosophy with others. And on the occasions I have in mind, I've already mentioned them, classes, discussion groups, colloquia are another example, though there the text is presented by the visiting speaker. All of those are text-based or text-centered events. And I find philosophizing with that kind of anchor just tremendously pleasurable. So I don't think I've really lost anything when it comes to true romance in deciding not to pursue a career in journalism.
Well, let's turn for question 4 away from work to the rest of your life and possible adventure there. So could you tell us about a hobby that you're embarrassed to admit?
Well, I have a couple of hobbies, actually. I'll mention both of them, though perhaps we'll have time for me to talk about only one. And I'm not embarrassed by either of them. I'm happy to talk about them, but they're the kinds of hobbies that other people may think I ought to be embarrassed by. I recall at a Hume Society conference confessing to a small group of people that I played the banjo, that being one of my hobbies. And there was a young Hume scholar there who just could not get his mind around that fact. He seemed, it seemed to be his view that it was beneath me to play the banjo. And he was very both, you know, perplexed and amused by it. So I have two hobbies, and they're both a little odd from the point of view of the larger culture, I think. I'm a bird watcher or birder, and I have been that for about 50 years now. And lately, because of the pandemic, which curtailed my travel, I've been photographing birds as well. And that's given me a great deal of satisfaction over the years. And the other hobby, as I mentioned, is playing the banjo. The banjo being, I think, another example of an old and neglected thing. You know, it's an ancient instrument, or not, maybe not ancient by the standards of musical instruments, but it's, you know, its origins go back to Africa at least 3 centuries ago. And the manner in which I play, it seems to be the manner in which the banjo or banjo-like instruments were originally played. So I don't play in that highly arpeggiated finger picking style that most people are familiar with that's characteristic of bluegrass music. I play an older style called clawhammer, which is highly rhythmic and less notey. And I started playing when I was 43, and I was, of course, terrible when I first started, and I'm not so bad now, but it's been very satisfying since the very beginning. Yeah, so that's a hobby that I'm very happy to confess to, though some find it possibly beneath me.
Well, I agree that you shouldn't be embarrassed by either of those, although I am amused by the idea that you have such gravitas as a philosopher that it's just incompatible with banjo playing. I can see how the banjo is sort of continuous with your interest in old and neglected things, and the pleasures of playing the banjo are easy for me to imagine, although I'm not musical at all myself. The pleasures of bird watching are much more obscure to me, and also seem much less close to your antiquarian interests or your interests in discussing texts with others and sort of the social interaction of philosophy. So I don't really know what it's like. I sort of imagine it as being extremely tedious and then periodically and solitary, and then periodically you see a bird. Can you say something? I'm missing something. What can you say something about the pleasure of it?
Yeah. I mean, just two quick things. It does fit in with the pleasure I take in finding things, because bird watching is just the continuous finding of things.
Right.
And it's true that you don't see a bird very often, but you hear them a lot. And so I went out on a walk this morning and I saw hardly anything, but I heard, I think I might have seen at most 10 different species of birds, but I heard 50. So my desire to discover things can be satisfied by that. And it's also the case that almost anything you do can satisfy your antiquarian interests, because birding made it natural for me to be interested in books about birding. And I enjoy reading old books about birding, even though many people who watch birds don't pay attention to these old books because they're out of date. They give you the wrong ranges for the species in question, for example. And so, you know, no self-respecting birder of a certain type would think it makes sense to look into it. So my antiquarian impulses can, at least to an extent, be satisfied by the birding. But it's true that for me, birding is largely not a social experience. I prefer to be alone, and I find walking alone and participating in my small way in patterns of life that have been established for thousands of years, I find that very gratifying. And I find discovering unusual things immensely gratifying. And every once in a while, I do make an exciting discovery. And it's a bit like finding a letter by Hume that no one has known of before.
Well, we have time for one last question, and this is another Iris Murdoch-inspired question beginning with a quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote. "What is he afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
I'm going to have to invoke this distinction, which I wish I had time to say more about, between the history of philosophy on the one hand and what many would think of as philosophy proper on the other, because one's fears as a practitioner of those two things seems to me they have to differ. As a historian of philosophy, my greatest fear isn't being wrong about something, because I'm pretty sure I'm wrong about a lot, and certainly my colleagues think that. My greatest fear is being uninformed, and that's not an interesting fear of the kind that Murdoch has in mind, because I think she's, when she speaks of philosophers in that remark, she's thinking of philosophers practicing what I've called philosophy proper. I think I'm not especially fearful. I do think this is a good question to ask of any philosopher. It's not always, maybe, may not always be that the answer is interesting. As I think about philosophers I know well, you know, I can imagine answers to the question that could be given on their behalf. Perhaps what Berkeley is most fearful of is forgetfulness of God. And perhaps Locke is most fearful of his being denied, or people of his sort being denied, freedom of mind. I can't think of any large thing of that sort that I'm fearful of. And it could be because of my skeptical disposition. I really am happy to hear all sides of a discussion, and happy to leave the kind of messy state of a discussion among people representing those different sides as the best representation of, quote, the answer, unquote, to the question that may have been at issue. So I'm maybe I need to go back to Iris Murdoch's first remark about the aim being to discover the truth. I do think, as I've said, that I'm trying to discover the truth as an engaged participant in the conversations I've been describing, but as someone who, at the same time he's pursuing his own particular path to the truth, is collaborating with his interlocutors in creating a discussion, which might be, if you like, the finished product. Perhaps the aim of discovering the truth is less important, and the real aim is a kind of understanding that can only come from appreciating the various things that might be said on all sides. It's too bad, by the way, that the finished product of, as I've just called it, is generally evanescent. The conversation ends, you know, it's like the set for the play being taken down. It ends, it's over, and there may be no record of it, but perhaps the fact that it's unrecorded contributes to the pleasure I take in it. I'm not sure.
Well, I can't believe it's taken this many episodes of the podcast for someone to respond to the Iris Murdoch question by asking about some historical philosophers, what are they afraid of? And I'm glad that we had a historian here to start doing that, and that it's a way of engaging with the question that has the kind of dialogic, text-based character that you said your tendency in philosophy leads you towards. So that seems perfect. We'll give that game as a gift to listeners. And I'll say thank you, Ken, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Ken Winkler is Kingman Brewster Jr. Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the author of Berkeley and Interpretation. Thanks for listening to Five Questions.